Dr. Barta Lee Heiner received her BA in theater in, from Brigham Young University and later attended the American Conservatory Theater, where she earned her Master's of Fine Arts in acting. She acted professionally with the Denver Center Theater while she taught acting and directed a conservatory projects for the National Theater Conservatory in Denver. Eventually, Barta was asked to return to BYU to strengthen the acting program in theater and media arts department. In 2005, she was invited to teach and to direct the MFA acting students at the Old Globe at the University of San Diego in George Bernard Shaw's Major Barbara. Barta is the head of the BFA acting program at BYU, where she teaches acting and directs plays at the university. As a member of the Screen Actors Guild and Actors Equity Association, Barta has performed in over 100 roles, and her directing credits span over 40 productions. Some of her favorite roles include Lettuce in Lettuce and Lovage, Abby Brewster in Arsenic and Old Lace, the title role in King Lear, Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd, and Mary Whitmer in The Fourth Witness. Recent directing projects have been a modernized version of Julius Caesar and a BFA senior acting project, The Seagull, at BYU. Her services as an acting and dialogue coach and consultant are in high demand, having recently worked on The Testaments of One Fold and One Shepherd and Emma Smith, My Story. Most recently, Barta has been involved with a student-mentored film project called Diantha's Crossing, a project that was inspired by her great-great-aunt, Diantha Farr Clayton. And now, Professor Heiner.
Konstantin Stanislavsky was a Russian actor, director, theoretician, and one of the greatest teachers of acting at the beginning of the 20th century. He demanded an inner truth from his actors instead of the traditional style of acting, which relied on external physical expression for dramatic effect. One of the improvisational concentration exercises he encouraged involved the magic if. He considered it to be the actor's key to opening up their imagination. For example, what if I'm living in Holland during the 1940s and have to go into hiding with my family because I'm Jewish? What if I returned home from hunting, tired and hungry, and in a rash moment traded my inheritance for a mess of pottage? Or what if I had been invited to speak in university forum about acting or the theories of acting? Richard Boleslavsky, another Russian acting teacher around the time of Stanislavsky, stated that acting is the life of the human soul receiving its birth through art. If I were to speak to you about acting and the human soul, I would also speak to you about counterfeits, of self-deception, of selling birthrights for pottage. In Tennessee Williams' play, The Glass Menagerie, which is set in the Great Depression, Amanda Wingfield says, "Life isn't easy. It calls for Spartan endurance." Well, life isn't easy. Although we have more abundance now, it is more difficult than before. Life, the good and evil, used to be more clearly defined, black and white, like the early days of film. Now, as W. Auden so aptly expresses in his poem, only God can tell the saintly from the suburban. Counterfeit values always resemble the true. I have had some experience with counterfeiting. It is almost a daily part of my life. It has been since childhood. The Greek word for actor is hypocrites, or pretender, counterfeiter. My early days of youth were spent in the cherry and poplar trees playing pirates with my nieces and nephews, under the lilac bushes playing cowboys and Indians, and around the barbecue pit and over the fence pretending to be a spy. Now, I don't want you to get the idea that actors are hypocrites or counterfeiters in real life. Most of the excellent actors and actresses I know are very honest and genuine people. They have a good, clean focus on what is important in life. They use their ability to pretend or counterfeit only when portraying characters in plays. A contemporary apostle, Boyd K. Packer, said, "Because of what artists do, we are able to feel and learn very quickly some spiritual things that we would otherwise learn very slowly." In speaking to my students about acting or creating a believable character in a play, I explain that what a character wants in each act or scene is called an objective. What a character wants ultimately out of the play, or in other words, out of life, is called a superobjective. And these objectives are only as strong as the obstacles the character has to overcome. In other words, what are you willing to do to give, what are you willing to do or give up to get what you want? Many professional acting teachers today profess that all character objectives and superobjectives are sexually motivated or driven by passion. In explaining my theory about acting, about character objectives, or people's needs and wants to my students here at this religious institution, I sometimes speak of a premortal existence. I feel that in this premortal existence, we enjoyed the all-encompassing love of a Father in heaven or a supreme being. And then we come to this earth and our memory is erased, but I believe that the longing for that love is still there. That love is incomprehensible, unattainable in this earthly state, yet we want to feel it, to sense it again. Some of us are blessed to have strong religious ties that become a guide in our lives. At moments, we and others who are searching for truth recapture a glimpse or taste of God's love. We know what we are missing, and we strive to return to his presence. There are others, though, because of the circumstances in which they have been born or paths they have trod, who do not have a clear vision or remembrance. They know something's missing in their lives but cannot grasp the connection. They search for it in many ways, trying to fill the vacuum. Some choose power, fame, drugs, lust, or other forms of gratification. Now, there's some of us who have had a glimpse or a taste of God's love, who have God's teachings of Christ or teachings from other religious sects, yet they still feel the need to question, to challenge what others have learned before them. Actually, that's good. I gained a stronger testimony of Christ's teachings by questioning, by searching for what was true. I kept in mind, however, what my father told me long ago. If there's a rule, God put it there for a reason. And before impulsively throwing away a rule, one should search deep for the reason behind the rule. I remember as a child hearing a story about a stagecoach company owner interviewing new drivers. The one question he put to them was, "When going around Dead Man's Curve, how close to the edge can you get without toppling over into the gorge?" One driver said, "I can get so close to the edge, it would be like slicing the hair of a rabbit." Another bettered the first by saying, "I can have two wheels soaring in the air like the wings of an eagle, while the other wheels will clutch onto the edge of the road like talons." And the third looked at the other two in amazement, and he said to the owner, "I can be reckless sometimes, but I ain't crazy. I'm going to stay as far away from the edge as I can." The owner gave a smile of relief and hired the third applicant. You see, the cargo and the passengers the first stagecoach was to carry was precious. It held the owner's wife and children. The cargo you carry is precious. It is your soul, your birthright, your life. A contemporary apostle, James E. Faust, cautioned in a 1995 LDS General Conference, "Your identity cannot be found from thrill-seeking, such as intentionally or unnecessarily exposing your life or your soul to any kind of danger, physical or moral. There will always be enough risks that will come to you naturally without your having to seek them out." I know from personal experience that what he said is true. My worst temptations came very subtly, quietly, slowly, from friends. Friends who were concerned friends who loved me and who said they cared about my welfare. I had acting instructors in my graduate program that I admired and that encouraged students to live on the edge of discovery, to experience everything about human nature because it would make them a better actor. Keep in mind, my college and graduate years were during the hippie era. Love was a word that was used very freely during that period. Another quote that helped me through that time of professional training and self-discovery was by Goethe. Whatever frees our spirit without giving us self-control is disastrous. I kept that close in my mind as my friends encouraged me to join in their explorations. I watched my friends from a distance at parties and opening night theater receptions expand and open their minds with drugs and alcohol, hop from couch to couch, bed to bed, as they searched for truth, freedom, love. Such beautiful words, and yet such counterfeits in which my friends found themselves wallowing. I should say some found themselves and pulled themselves out, but some didn't. So some are no longer with us because of the decisions they made or the objectives they chose. Two of the men I went through graduate school with were Harry and Greg. They were roommates, and they both led a bit of the wild life. But Harry was wise and became disciplined. In my opinion, Greg was the better actor, but Greg got caught up in counterfeits. When I went to visit Harry some years after we had graduated, Harry had done a couple of movies and was being considered for a role in an upcoming television series. Harry told me Greg was doing some carpentry work for him because Greg was in need of money and couldn't hold down a job. Harry didn't know how much longer he could help Greg because of the quality of his work. It was getting worse the more and more he was controlled by drugs. Remember, Greg was the better actor, but Harry was wise. I had another friend back in college who was given an LDS general authority blessing while he was on his mission. In this blessing, he was told he was to further the arts in the church. He had great dreams of an art complex that would house an arts gallery, dance studio, a symphony hall, two theaters for film and stage, and a repertory company of actors and actresses, similar to the one that Brigham Young started in Salt Lake City. I remember my heart leaping as I shared his dreams. I had been praying for an understanding of what I was to do with my talents, and I felt this was an answer to my prayer. After graduation, I eventually auditioned for a Master of Fine Arts program and was accepted. I started a training that I felt would perfect my craft. I wanted to hone my talents and give them as a gift to God. It included classes in history, clothing styles through the ages, a period movement, or how to move or sit down in a corset, ballet, tap dancing, modern dance, singing, classes in contemporary and classical acting, emotional recall, sense memory, Shakespeare text work and scansion, voice production, word stress and inflections, phonetics, heroics, Tai Chi Chuan, yoga, improvisation, Alexander and Feldenkrais movement. And you thought actors had it easy. While I was in graduate school, I heard that my friend from college, who had been given that blessing, had chosen an alternate lifestyle. A few years later, I was performing as a guest artist here at BYU, and while I was in the makeup room preparing for performance, I received word that my friend had died from AIDS. I started to weep, not only because of his death, but also because of the loss of his birthright. I thought, how could he leave the church when he had been given such a blessing, when he knew of his potential? There's an interesting phenomenon about counterfeiting. Counterfeits can look so good, feel so good, so like the genuine. You ask yourself, how can something that is supposed to be so bad for you feel so good? Sometimes you can rationalize yourself into believing that what you feel is what is true. Remember, counterfeit values always resemble the true. Sometimes what you feel is true. A spiritual experience usually has some kind of emotional confirmation tied to it. But there's a fine line between a spiritual and an emotional experience. I was an assistant director for the Hill Cumorah pageant in Palmyra, New York, for about 3 years. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's a reenactment of what happened on this continent during the crucifixion of our Lord. The earthquake, days of darkness, and then an actor portraying Christ magically appears quite a number of feet above the tallest stage and descends to meet the repentant multitude below. If all goes well, technically, it's quite a spectacular moment. One summer, during a performance of that scene, a woman in the cast truly believed that Christ had literally come and replaced the actor descending from above. You could not convince her otherwise. She had had a spiritual experience. I have no doubt that it was a spiritual experience for her, but in actuality, Christ had not appeared. The woman had experienced an emotional connection with the scene. She had subconsciously used Stanislavski's magic if exercise. Many actors do experience the magic if while performing. They can, with concentration, get caught up in an emotion of a finely written and directed play and have a cathartic experience. They feel what it would feel like if they were truly in the circumstances of that character. And through observing, the audience can also have a vicarious cathartic experience. A study was done a number of years ago on some actors and their ability to empathetically connect with other people's emotions. First, people who had experienced deeply emotional traumas were connected to electrodes that would register their heartbeat, breathing, etc., and they were asked to relate their highly emotional experiences. Their monologues were recorded, and also their physical reactions were documented. Next, actors were asked to memorize and then perform the monologues of those people. Electrodes were placed on their bodies, and while they were performing, it was discovered that a few of the actors were so finely tuned in their acting or counterfeiting that their bodies could reproduce exactly the same physical and emotional reactions of stress, fear, anger, sickness that was registered in the people who were truly going through those experiences. The difference between the two is that the actor has the gift and ability to disengage themselves from those emotions once they finish those monologues, whereas the people who actually lived through those traumatic experiences were still left with the remnants of those emotions. It is important for us to be able to discern the difference between a spiritual and an emotional experience. Sometimes what we want is not what is best for us. Sometimes we can get caught up in the excitement of a relationship and feel a spiritual prompting or a feeling that this is the real thing, that he or she is the one, when in actuality it is only an emotional surge. Remember, we have had our bodies for only a very short time, eternally speaking. We have not fully understood their workings. I've spoken about counterfeits in love, in truth, in freedom. Let's talk about counterfeits in power and fame. Let's talk about Salieri and Mozart. In the play and film Amadeus, Salieri has dedicated his life to doing good works for God. He wants to create divine music that has reached the heights of heaven. But God didn't bless Salieri with that gift. He blessed Mozart. Sniveling Mozart, who doesn't care about pleasing God, but only gratifying himself. Salieri feels that God is mocking him. He rejects God and goes about to destroy Mozart and succeeds. But I don't believe God was mocking Salieri. I believe God loved Salieri, but needed him to nurture, encourage, and inspire Amadeus to even greater music. Perhaps in return, even Salieri's music would have become greater. In the eternal perspective of things, our personal objectives or what we want, no matter how grand the reason, may not be what God needs us to do. If you will have faith in me, ye shall have power to do whatsoever thing is expedient in me. That's from Moroni 7:33. I looked up expedient ages ago. Expedient means whatever is best in the long run. In other words, you may have a worthy cause, a great need for something in your perspective, but if it is not best for all those concerned, for the eternal perspective of things, you may not get what you want. I always hated that scripture. While I was growing up, it was difficult for me to understand that someone else's needs might be more important, especially when that someone might be totally unknown to me. In the 1995 October General Conference for the LDS Church, President Gordon P. Hinckley beautifully stated his super objective in life. And I believe he encourages us to have the same focus in mind. He said, "We are all in this great endeavor together. We are here to assist our Father in his work and glory to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Your obligation is as serious in your sphere of responsibility as is mine in my obligation in my sphere. The progress of this work will be determined by our joint efforts." In other words, according to a Scottish proverb, "Whate'er thou art, act well thy part." As a young girl, I wanted to be another Katharine Hepburn or Meryl Streep. Of course, Meryl Streep wasn't Meryl Streep when I was young, so I wanted to be Katharine Hepburn. I was going to be rich and famous, and until I got married, I was going to have a mansion full of orphans and stray animals. And as I got older, my dreams matured a little. However, I still wanted to dedicate myself to the Lord in doing good works with my talents. Several years ago, I was performing with Denver Center Theater and teaching at the National Theater Conservatory. It was an ideal situation, one that my professional peers in other cities would envy. And then I received a call from one of my former teachers at BYU. There was an opening in the department. They were interested in having me return to strengthen their acting program. And I said, "No, thank you." Returning to Provo would have been like committing professional suicide. A couple of months later, the same offer came, and I was encouraged to really think about it. And so I did, and I prayed, and I got this feeling I was to return to BYU. And then I started to analyze myself. Was this a spiritual prompting or just sentimentalism? Was that really what God wanted me to do, or was it just indigestion? You must realize that I'm one of those who doesn't receive clear, strong spiritual promptings. I have to struggle and ponder and evaluate. I have great hindsight. I can see, as I look back, how God has protected me and saved me from some very stupid mistakes. But foresight, I haven't cultivated that gift as yet. So I prayed again. Was that another prompting? But I wasn't sure. And what if it was? Then I got angry. I didn't pray for about 2 weeks. I thought, I'm a professional actress. I've worked long and hard to be where I am. I don't want to go back to teach at BYU. And I struggled and pondered, and a thought came to me. You are teaching a group of mostly amoral people how to succeed in acting. Who is teaching those students who are trying to be moral? I prayed again, and I begged God not to send me back to Provo. And still, that odd feeling of heartburn or indigestion, nothing really strong. I felt like I was reliving that old story of the child who took a lunch to his father who was digging out a well. Child leaned over the well, called out to the father. A hole was dark and deep, and the bottom of the well could not be seen. And the father called up to the child and told him to drop the lunch sack down to him. The child drops the lunch sack into the dark hole and heard his father respond that he'd received it. The father then told the child to jump down into his arms so they could share the lunch. The child hesitated. What if the father had made a mistake? What if he does make a mistake and misses? Was the father really there? What if my promptings were incorrect? Was I really supposed to give up all that I had worked for? And still I jumped. I returned here, still questioning why I needed to come back. Had I misinterpreted what I had felt? Was it really necessary for me to be here? And a few months later, into the semester, I became aware that they were producing a new version of the Hill Cumorah pageant. I went to the director and I offered my services. Perhaps this was why I was here. Maybe that would make me feel better. However, there was no need. All directing slots were full. So a month or so later, though, a slot was open, and I found myself directing on the Hill. But still I questioned the need for me to be teaching at BYU. A year or so later, I was reading about my great-grandfather, and he, in turn, was writing about his great-grandfather. My great-great-great-grandfather, Freeman, was nicknamed John the Baptist by his children because while he was alive, he counseled his children that none of the churches were true. Someday, he said, the true church will be restored and there will be apostles and prophets and all the gifts and blessings of the gospel like in the days of Christ. He prepared his children to recognize and embrace the gospel, just as John the Baptist prepared the way for Christ. But my great-great-great-grandfather never received the fullness of the gospel in his lifetime. I thought to myself amid tears, that's what I am. A John the Baptist, or a Joan. I'm probably supposed to prepare all these students to go out into the world and succeed. They'll create a great arts complex just like my friend and I dreamed of long ago. I'll be dead before my dreams ever come to fruition. I wallowed in that thought for a few weeks, and then one day I thought to myself, what in the heck is wrong with John the Baptist? John the Baptist was a great man. He was the main transitioning force between the world of the Old Testament and Christ's world of the New Testament. He was needed to prepare the way. If I honestly believe the gospel is true, then I need to do what God needs me to do now. Perhaps what I want to do will come later in my life. Another quote from President Hinckley: the time has come for us to stand a little taller. It is a time to move forward without hesitation, knowing well the meaning, the breadth, and the importance of our mission. It is a time to do what is right, regardless of the consequences that might follow. I was watching the Discovery Channel a few months ago, a program about the Mayans. The narrator was saying that the Maya calendar is still the most accurate calendar known to us. They were interviewing an old Mayan shaman who could recite all the important historical dates from the past and supposedly in the future. He was counting on pieces of stone and reciting in Mayan. The narrator informed us that the old shaman recited history clear up until the year 2012 and then stopped. When he asked the shaman why he'd stopped, he said, because there is no more time. Time stops after that. Now, perhaps that just meant that time as we know it will change somehow. Or perhaps that means there will be a huge historical event. Christians have been saying for years, or hundreds of years, that the millennium is near. We have heard it so long, I think some of us are complacent about it, thinking, oh, well, it won't happen in my time. Actually, in the year 2000, people thought, you know, that's when it was happening then. But 2012, what if that were true? Whether it's true or not, I do believe something wonderful is going to happen sometime in the future because I believe someone wonderful is coming. And because of that, I believe Satan is waging a very strong war full of counterfeits and deceit. You see, he has a very strong super objective, too. He started preparing his assault on some of us many years ago, even when we were children. Winning the war was that important to him. That's why God needs us to be warriors. See, Terry Warner said, where good and evil are concerned, there's no such thing as being sidelined or taking time out. Everything we do, everything we say, everything we think and feel make a difference, especially considering the season of war in which we live. When war is being waged, wasting time becomes malingering. Selfishness counts as hoarding material needed for battle. A little casual sin collaborates with the enemy. We must, quite literally, take care, for we can overcome Satan and his angels only in the way we overcame them in heaven, by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of our testimonies, staying true in spite of the cost, even unto death. There are some of us in real life who have been victims of horrible counterfeits, of mental, physical, or sexual abuse, victims of hypocrisy or hypocrites. I'm not speaking of the Greek meaning of the word, but of the modern day meaning, a person who puts on a false appearance of virtue or religion. Spiritual hypocrites, whose words, according to Shakespeare, fly up to heaven, but whose thoughts remain below. Hypocrites to the outside world lead a perfect life, but whose true self is distorted and untrue. These experiences of abuse may at times make it difficult for some of us to discern truth from error. Sometimes counterfeits, because they have been introduced to us by those we love, admire, and respect as a child, seem oddly comfortable and pleasing to us when we are approached with them again. They feel so good, so incredibly good, so enticingly, hypnotically good. But they are counterfeits, messes of pottage. I am here today to plead with you. Do not throw your birthrights away out of anger or confusion. Some of you will be tested and strained beyond other people's imaginations, but don't give up. You may be the very key needed to further God's plan. It may take years before another is prepared to take your place. God did not make those rules without a reason. Study and ponder and pray and trust in those who have blazed trails before you. Get counseling from people who are spiritually in tune and who have been clinically trained to discern counterfeits. And if for whatever reason you have faltered or do falter at some time, please come back. Come home. The road may be difficult, but the longer you stay away, the more difficult it will be. Come home. I believe Christ gave up his life for us so that we could come home. I have personal experience. I have tasted some of the fruits of these counterfeits and know that life isn't easy. It calls for Spartan endurance. We are in a war zone of counterfeits and deceit, some so subtle, so difficult to discern that you may not know until you are right in the middle asking yourself, how did I ever get here? But don't stay. Come home. Reevaluate your objectives, your super objective in life. There are important things for all of us to do, whether they are great or small in the eyes of the world, doesn't matter. They are great in the eyes of the Lord. I'm not saying give up your dreams. Dreams are what this world is made of. But if for some reason in your life you feel a prompting, a slight sensation of indigestion, if what you want to do doesn't turn out to be what the Lord needs from you at this time in your life, understand that God loves you, but needs you somewhere else for the moment. Be patient and trusting. I believe there is still time, a whole eternity, to do what you want to do. Thank you.